morning, good afternoon, or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit whose programs include the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. Come visit Bookmarks at our community gathering space and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Inside the Writer's Studio is also proud to be an affiliate of Libro FM, the audiobook platform that supports your local independent bookstore. Stay tuned at the end of the podcast for more information on Libro FM and a special offer. My guest today is Steve Barry, whose new Cotton Malone thriller, The Lost Kingdom, will be published next week. Steve, welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio.
Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
So to start out with, just tell us a little bit about the setup for The Lost Kingdom.
Well, it involves one of my favorite places in the world, which is Bavaria. I really love that place. I've been there many times. It also involves one of my favorite historical characters, King Ludwig II. And I've been trying for years to come up with a story that would, I could bring Cotton Malone into that world and use those two elements in the story. It was tough until I stumbled across a couple of interesting facts. One I can talk about, one I can't, because it'll give away something in the novel. But the one I can talk about is very interesting. Ludwig II, many people call him mad, but that's not a good description. I don't think he was mad. I think he was suffering from depression or maybe bipolar. He certainly had some issues. There's no question. I think today he would be very treatable, but in the mid to late 19th century, that just wasn't the case. He did not like being confined to government. He loved being king, but he had a romantic notion of being king, that a king should be like Louis XIV was, to be able to do whatever he wanted to, whenever he wanted to, however he wanted to, no matter what. Well, unfortunately, that's not practical, but in his mind, that's what he was. He was so disillusioned with ruling Bavaria that he actually sent a man around the world to try to find him another kingdom where he could lead and rule the way he wanted to. And this guy actually did. He went around all over the place looking. They never found it in real life, but in this novel, they do. And now China, Germany, and the United States are all after it, but for totally different reasons.
Yeah. Now, I have to admit, I didn't really know very much about Ludwig, or even really about the sort of history of what we now call Germany, you know, prior to the First World War. You talk about him being possibly bipolar or some other sort of issues. How do you research the personality of somebody who died 150 years ago? I mean, I understand how you can research the facts of his life, but how do you get at his personality, which really comes out on the, especially these opening pages of the novel?
There's a lot of firsthand accounts of people who interacted with Ludwig, and I read those. So there's quite a few of those, actually. The guy that I just told you that went around the world wrote a journal that details a lot about Ludwig in it. So there's a lot of observation. Now, there's also a lot of misinformation about Ludwig. A lot of things that came out after his death and a lot of things to disparage him. You take some of it with a grain of salt, but you know, overall, he definitely suffered from some mental problems. There's no question. I mean, he slept all day and he would live all night. That's what he would do. He didn't want to be around people. He couldn't stand anyone staring at him for very long. He had little to no interaction. He fantasized that he was eating dinner with Marie Antoinette and Louis XIV. He talked to these characters as if they were alive and there. He had some issues, there's no question. And these are all from firsthand accounts. These were ultimately used against him when they deposed him and removed him as king in 1886. So we actually have that too, all the things that happened there. So there's plenty of firsthand accounts that you can get a good feel for Ludwig.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I wasn't surprised to hear you say that you have a love for Bavaria. I mean, that comes out so much, especially again in the early pages of the novel. And since it is a thriller with lots of twists and turns, we're going to talk mostly about early pages so we don't give anything away. But tell us a little more. What is it about Bavaria that sort of draws you in and makes you want to write about it? I mean, there was just so much there in those first scenes.
Well, it's it's what you think of a fairy tale land would look like. I mean, it really does. The architecture, the painted buildings, the mountains, the valleys, the green pines, the snow. I've been there many times when there's snow there. I've been there at Christmas time. It's really magical at Christmas time. Everything about it has a ring of a fairy tale land. And when you're there, you feel that way. There's a different feeling being there. I loved it. And I still do. And so I was very fortunate that I was able to find a story and finally get Cotton Malone there.
So I think when a lot of people think of Bavaria and they think of King Ludwig, they think of the castle, that fairy tale castle, which name I can't pronounce, but you'll pronounce it for me.
I will.
But this book begins in a different home that he built that I had not heard about. Tell us about that. I found the story of that absolutely fascinating.
Now, he built three castles. He wanted to build a fourth, but never got a chance to do that. The three castles are Haarlemkimse, which is what the one you're speaking of that opens the novel, Linderhof, which is the smallest of the three, the one he actually finished, and then Neuschwanstein. That one we know because of Walt Disney. He visited it in the 1930s, and it became the model for Sleeping Beauty's castle in Disneyland. So it's very familiar to readers when they see Neuschwanstein. He never finished Haarlemkimse and Neuschwanstein, but there's enough of it finished that is quite remarkable. The novel centers around these three castles, and particularly in Neuschwanstein, we go up inside, Haarlemkimse, we go inside, and in Linderhof, we go to the grotto, which is outside the castle, which is quite remarkable. So I wanted all of those places to become almost characters of the novel. Haarlemkimse was his ode to Louis XIV. It was a copy of Versailles. He never finished it, though. He only got the center part built. But there is a hall of mirrors there that's actually larger than the one at Versailles. It's a very reminiscent of it, very close copy of it. There's a lot about the castle that when you go to Versailles, you would notice some similarities to. He only finished, you know, a small portion of the castle. But there's enough there you get a feel for it. And so the early part of the book takes place there. And then we end up in the other two castles as the story progresses.
I mean, I have to warn our listeners that when you read this book, you're going to want to go to Bavaria. You're going to want to see these castles. The richness of detail is just amazing. Now, this is a Cotton Malone story. This is a hero that has appeared in previous books. And it's a hero who, like me, once in my life, is an antiquarian bookseller, a dealer in rare books. What attracted you to that particular profession for your protagonist?
Well, I like books. I've always liked books, and I've always frequented old bookshops. I found a lot of my research is bought. In fact, I do the majority of my research at a very huge used bookshop in Jacksonville, Florida, called the Chamblin Book Mine. Yeah. And I go there and buy hundreds of books from there all the time. So I'm very familiar with antique bookshops. Now, Cotton's is a used bookshop. It's also a rare bookshop. He's a collector. He'll go out and find what you need. And I thought, you know, when I was creating him in the Templar legacy, you know, you got to come up with something different, something fresh, something that no one's done. And in 2006, there were no booksellers being thrillers and being the protagonist in a thriller. So it just occurred to me that would be a nice catch. And so he's a retired Justice Department agent. He retired out early in his late 40s. He moves to Copenhagen and he starts a new life with this bookshop. And he's had 17 adventures now. This is the 17th Cotton Malone. Readers should not be put off by that, though, because you do not have to read them in any sequence. You can read them in any sequence you like. And I write them that way on purpose so that you can start anywhere in the series and pick up with it. So each one of the books is action, history, secrets, conspiracy. So they're the same in that regard. But they are different in that they deal with different history, different points of time, different antagonists, different motivations. And that's the trick when you want to write a series. Every book in the series has to be the same but different.
Right.
That's a little bit of a tall order, but that's how I balance it out.
Well, I mean, I have to say, after my many years in the book business, both as a dealer and a collector,
I think there are similarities between the espionage world and the book collecting world. You know, we do go down some strange rabbit holes in this world. So I'm happy to see a bookseller in that world of espionage. There's one point early on when Cotton is dealing with a particular situation. It doesn't quite go to plan. And he says that improvising is the key to his success. How much, for you, how much of writing is improvising? How much of it is planning ahead? How much of it is you make a plan, but then it doesn't quite go to plan?
Well, it's usually the latter one there. You know, you plot a book out. And I try to plot about 50 pages ahead of myself. I like to stay about 50 or 100 pages ahead. And you do the best you can, but it inevitably doesn't work out. And you have to come back and change and fix and repair. So there's a combination of planning and spontaneity, because spontaneity comes as you're writing the novel and something hits you and goes, oh, wow, no, that's what I got to do right there. Oh, wait a minute, I got to go back and rewrite a whole section of this book to make it work. That's okay. Go back and do it. It would be wonderful if I could sit down for 6 months and plot a novel out in every little detail all the way through and then write the novel from that outline with everything already determined and all these little cool things already thought through. But unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. I have 12 months to produce that novel and I have to kind of plot and write at the same time. So I would prefer to do it, you know, the planning way, but I'm a little more seat of the pants now than I used to be. Mm-hmm.
Well, as we're talking about that, let's talk about craft a little bit. One of the things I noticed in your writing is you make very strong use of the single sentence paragraph, which I love. I love a paragraph that's one sentence that just, you know, hits you, strikes you, tells you something that's so important that it deserves its own paragraph. Can you talk a little bit about just the art of form and structure, specifically in thriller writing?
Well, the object of thriller writing is to keep the reader's eye moving down the page. It is not an exercise in grammar. It is not an exercise in correctness. It's an exercise in keeping the eyes moving down the page. Now, to do that, we have determined and learned from experience that short paragraphs, short chapters, and short sentences can accomplish that a whole lot faster than the opposite will do. So I tend to have my average sentence lengths maybe 10 words. I keep the words that you understand. You don't have to go to a dictionary and look them up every time I put them down there. I like one sentence paragraphs. They are almost for me like a period at the end of a thought. Yeah. They're a way to end a thought. They're a way to put emphasis to a thought. They're a way to draw attention to that thought, because my one sentence paragraphs come almost exclusively within interior monologue, where a character is talking to themselves or thinking to themselves. So I use that as a way to signal to the reader, well, I'm done with that thought now. Now here we're going to something else. And it keeps that eye moving down the page, because that's how we get graded in the thriller business. How fast can a reader read the book?
Yeah.
Hemingway changed the way novels were written. We came away from the 19th century and early 20th century writing, where you had long paragraphs and long sentences and long thoughts. He shortened everything up, but even today, I think Hemingway might be considered a tad wordy.
Yeah.
You have to be even tighter today with it because of, we have the internet and we have everything else competing against us that he didn't have. So we have to adjust, and that's the way I like to read books, and so that's the way I write books.
One of the things I found myself paying really close attention to in my most recent novel, which was my first attempt at thriller writing, was the pacing. And this book, The Lost Kingdom, starts it with, you know, at a good clip. We drop in right in the middle of an action sequence, basically. But can you talk a little bit about pacing and how you kind of alternate the more intense action sequences with those moments in between?
Well, there's a rule that you tend to do with these scenes, and I was taught it a long time ago. And it's basically start late, get out early. And basically what that means is start that scene as far into it as you can. You don't need all this buildup. Get Start late. Get as far into the scene as you can get when you start it, and then get out as quick as you can. So start late, get out early. If you can do that with all of your scenes, you're doing really well. And I try to adhere to that. I don't like a lot of buildup. I don't like a lot of, anticipation and that kind of thing. There's a little bit. You always have to have that. And in my novels, I have history and I have information that is also comes out. So I have to learn to mix information with action. And in my genre, that's probably the hardest thing we have to do, is mixing information with action. And I'm not saying I'm great at it or good at it. I'm just saying that I'm conscious of it. I'm very conscious of mixing information with action, being as careful as I can. My first reader of the manuscript is always my wife, Elizabeth, and she is very intolerant of too much of information. So she's very good at saying, you got a little too much there, man. A couple sentences too many there. Or sometimes she says, you didn't give me quite enough there. I didn't really understand what you said. So mixing that information with action is very tricky. Very, very tricky. Getting in late and getting out early, though, will serve you well, will always serve you well.
Yeah, I was very aware of not wanting to stop the action for, five pages while somebody gives you a lecture on a piece of historical information that the reader needs to know about.
It's too much. You can give me five sentences of that.
Yeah.
But not even five paragraphs really of that would be good enough. You got to be very, very careful when you're mixing the information with action. But if I leave the information out, people go, where is the stuff? So I have to find that balance, and it's sometimes tricky. I try the best I can to get a balance.
So I notice when you begin a new chapter or a new section, especially when it's one where the action isn't continuous, a lot of times you start with a sentence, again, a short sentence, that really grabs the reader's attention. The one I wrote down was, Stefan von Bern loved hookers. Like, to me, that's like, okay, I want to know more. We talk a lot in writing thrillers and writing mysteries about the ends of chapters, about cliffhangers. Talk about the art of crafting the beginning of a chapter or a section so that it draws the reader in.
The beginning is so critical. In fact, it's the most critical. Number one, every single chapter I've ever written in my life starts with a name. You always start with a name, always, because you have to establish the point of view of that chapter immediately. That is not something you can put off. That is not something you can delay. It has to be done instantaneously. Immediately after that, I need time and place, unless time and place is obvious. Like from the previous scene, you know exactly where you are. You don't have to repeat that. But you got to give me a name immediately. Every single chapter I've ever written in my life starts with a name. And you go from there. And the first sentence doesn't have to be, obviously you can't do every chapter with a clever first sentence, because it's just hard to do. And you don't need to either, by the way. But that one you just quoted was the first time you met Stefan.
Yeah.
Since this is when you're learning him for the very first time. So I gave you a little more oomph in there. The first sentence of a novel, though, has got to be really good. And this is where writers today really don't pay much attention to it anymore. They don't think that's an important consideration, but it is. Yeah. It's extremely important. Your first sentence of a novel has to kind of grab you. It doesn't have to be "Call me Ishmael." It doesn't have to be, like that, but it has to be something that draws you immediately in and wants you to know more. If you have a prologue, you have to have a great sentence there, then a great sentence at chapter one. You have to have both. And I read a lot of manuscripts for blurbs from first-time writers, and they just don't pay attention to this. They don't think this is important, but it is. It's critically important.
There's a line when you're talking about Stefan and the city of Munich, and you write, the city survived just like himself. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the relationship between setting and character, and how setting can even reflect character.
Well, for me, it's critical, because the places that I choose to set the novel become almost characters in the story. And that's sort of a trademark thing that I've set up for myself over the last 20 years. That's sort of, if you say about a Steve Barry novel, well, Steve Barry novel has places, and places become very important to what's going on. I just don't put you in this place out of clear blue sky. There's a reason why we're in this place. There's a reason why the history I'm telling you about, because it's going to come into play later. It's going to come into play at some point in time here, what I'm telling you. And so that's sort of my niche. So for me, place is critical. Place is very, very important. And I make them as descriptive as I can. It also is a little bit of a liability, because when producers want to buy the thing and make a movie or something out of it, they, of course, look and say, oh, my God, we've got to go to these places. We can't film this in a back lot somewhere. That's the dilemma I think we found for years with people who option my stuff. They figure out it's pretty expensive to make a movie out of one of these things. But it's what my readers want. That's what they're after, is those places. And that's why you couldn't skimp on that.
Yeah. One of the things I discovered when I was working on the Enigma affair, I thought, you know, I hadn't read lots of thrillers. And I thought, how did I come to think that this is how you write a thriller? And I realized that a lot of what I learned about building suspense, about pacing, about all these other elements, I actually learned from Alfred Hitchcock, from both his films and from listening to him comment on his films and talk about the art of suspense. Where did you learn the art of thriller writing? What are the influences that led you to all of these aspects that we're talking about?
Well, Hitchcock certainly was an influence. You're right. I mean, he was great at maintaining suspense, building tension, foreshadowing things that come later. There's no wasted words or wasted scenes in a Hitchcock film. Every one of those scenes are going to have something to do with something later on. It's kind of like the Onion movies today, the Knives Out movies. You watch those two movies, every single thing that goes on in those movies early on is going to come back later. Every single thing. You got to pay real close attention because it's coming back. Every single thing is coming. And I like that. I mean, there's no wastedness about it. I learned from reading Cussler, Ludlum.
Yep.
I learned a lot from those guys. I probably learned the most, though, when I read Angels and Demons back in the early 90s. I bought it when it first came out and read it and went, wow, the way this guy blocks off his chapters, the way he blocks off his sequence. And at this point, nobody knew who Dan Brown was. They didn't pay any attention to him. When Da Vinci came out about 12, 13 years later, I read it again. And I actually changed the way I plotted books. Mm-hmm. If you read The Amber Room, The Romanoff Prophecy, and The Third Secret, and then you read The Templar Legacy, you will notice a difference between my writing. It changed. The way I plotted a book, the way I blocked off scenes, the way I did things, and because I read Da Vinci. And then I read Angels and Demons again, and I learned from Dan Brown how to do that. And I'm not the only one. I know a lot of writers who learned from that, who altered the way they wrote as well from learning from Dan's style. And I've taken that style now, and I've taken it a little further, and I've made my own refinements to it now as to how to do that. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So you write about espionage and espionage organizations, and, you know, those organizations and people who are involved in them are by their very nature secretive. How do you research something that we're not supposed to know about, like the workings of a CIA agent or other sort of people who are working in the espionage world?
There's a lot of books on this. I mean, there's a lot of memoirs that have been written by people who were in that business. There's a lot out there. So you can learn a lot about them. And then talking to them too, I've known some. So I've learned firsthand as they've explained things to me privately about how things are done and how things happen. So you just sort of soak it in as it comes in and learn. And then from there, you can add a little imagination to it. I mean, Ian Fleming added a little imagination to James Bond and added a little element to him that's not necessarily in real life, but there's a little bit there. And I do the same thing. I take from what I learn and read and from hear from people, then I add my own little twist to it. But I try to keep my stuff as realistic as possible. I really do. I give it the best I can, because you just can't, you can take some liberties, but you can't go too far with it. In my world, there's not a lot of violence. I have violence because you have to have it in a thriller, but I keep it to a minimum. The killing in my books is to a minimum. If someone dies in one of my books, they really had to die. Mm-hmm. There was a reason they had to die, and it was important that they had to die. So I'm careful with that because killing is a big deal and dying is a big deal. And I don't want to, you know, make it flippant. I don't have huge body counts in my novels. There are some where there had to be multiple people had to die simultaneously in an event, but there was a reason why they had to do that. I try to be very careful with that. So my books are not as violent. That's one reason why I don't sell very well in Germany. Germans like their thrillers a little more violent, but it's also a reason why I sell really well in France because they don't.
Yeah.
So it depends on, you know, where you are in the world.
There's a point at which Cotton talks about not doing some of the things that you see police officers and investigators doing on television shows and in movies. And I remember reading a memoir of a CIA agent one time who said, you know, that James Bond, when there's a huge car chase, when there's a giant gunfight in a public square, that means that the spy is not really doing a very good job of
correct.
Of secret. What are some of the differences between the actual ways that intelligence gathering works and the ways that they're portrayed in popular culture?
One thing I was taught by people in the business, and they made this very clear to me, they said, if I have to get my gun out and start shooting, something has gone horribly wrong, mm-hmm. and I have not done my job properly. So Cotton rarely pulls the trigger. He does pull the trigger, but rare. It's a rare occurrence that he has to do it. And he only pulls the trigger when things have gone terribly wrong and very wrong in it. So I'm conscious about that and I'm careful about that. In real life, spies and espionage work very quietly. You never even know they're there. The best spy is the one you would never think was a spy, that you would never suspect in a million years. And they're very, very good at what they do. And so I'm cognizant of that fact too, to try to be clear about that. Now, I do have some paid assassins in books, but there are such things as paid assassins. They are people who make their living killing people, and they're very good at it. So, you know, that makes for great in the thrillers. In my books, though, they always, in the end, kind of get their coming dues. You know, they don't really get to do it indiscriminately. They actually have to pay a price. In all of my books, the bad guy always loses and the bad guy always pays the price. I try to make that, but the good guy wins, the bad guy loses and usually loses his life. If I had a bad guy survive a novel, and I think I had it one time, I would have had a reason for that, that I might want to come back to him one day, but I never did go back to him one day.
Yeah. This novel makes, and many of your novels makes very strong connection between the past and the present, both in plot, in characters, in setting, in these details of the props, that these items from the past that we find in the present. How do you go about writing those connections? Are you working with a present story and then looking for things in the past that will make those connections? Or are you researching the historical past and trying to think of a present story that will fit with what you discovered?
Doing both at the same time, because I've got to come up with this thing from the past, and this thing has to be real. I can't make it up. A lot of thriller writers just make up the thing that they want to deal with. I can't do that. Mine has to be real. Not only does it have to be real, it's got to be pretty cool. Like, you kind of go like, ooh, and there's one in this book, but I can't tell you what it is because it'll give away the story. But there is one here. And when I heard about it, I went, oh, wow, that is pretty cool. And that is real. Let's see if we can weave this story around this thing, since now we got it. So this is what I call the ooh factor, the thing that you kind of go, ooh, ooh, that's pretty cool. That's pretty neat. Then I have to have the so what. This thing from the past that's pretty cool that makes you say ooh still has to matter today. Yeah. It still has to have some significance today, because otherwise, who cares? Who cares if Queen Elizabeth I might have been a man? All right, it's interesting, but who cares? Well, I came up with a so what. Why you care? Who cares if we find the Amber Room? Well, I came up with a reason why it became important. In this book, who cares if Ludwig II was looking for another kingdom? Well, there is a reason, and it matters today. So I have to find both of these elements, and then I have to weave this story together, trying to keep it about 90% to reality, as close as I can to reality, because that's another niche I've carved for myself that my readers like, that I keep it as close as I can. I'm writing a thriller, though. I'm trying to entertain you, so I've got to trip it up, and that's where the 10% comes from. That's why I also put a writer's note in the back of every book that tells you where I trip it up, so that you know, when you get done, what's real and what's not.
Yeah. And to me, that as I mean, when I was listening to you talk just then, I thought this is exactly the way I wrote, you know, The Enigma Affair, with the interesting thing from the past, make it relevant to the present. But it's that 10% that I found the most fun, the making up the part of history that perfectly fits with the real story, but is the bit that I'm going to tell you in the author's note, no, I made that part up. Can you talk a little bit about that, the art of that, of creating a false history that just fits seamlessly with the real history?
The trick is to make that little bit of that trip up of the story so minor that the reader doesn't even mind. In fact, the reader doesn't even notice, and maybe the reader might even say, well, is that real? Mm-hmm. Is that true? I get that question all the time when I get done. Someone will read the book and they'll say, is that real? And they're talking about the 10%.
Yeah.
Saying, is that real? Did that really happen? I said, no, that was me. But if you can seamlessly put it in there to where they don't even notice where it is, that's great. And that's what I try to do. It's hard. You have to be careful. You have to be real careful to twist it in. And in this book, it was pretty easy to do because it fit perfectly with where it went. It all kind of went together perfectly. And I could just seamlessly trip this one little thing in here about the last kingdom. And there's one other little fact from history that I had to change, one little thing, just a little twist that I had a little change to make it work. But I tell you about both in the writer's note, so you know what they are.
I mean, one of my favorite reactions from readers is always, I couldn't find that guy on Wikipedia, you know, believe that the one that you invented was something that was.
Yeah, I get that all the time about towns and places, like, you know, I've looked everywhere. I can't find that town. I mean, where is it? Where is it? And of course, it doesn't exist.
It's not there. No. The New York Times wrote that you have a feel for what they call the factual gaps that give history its tantalizing air of the unknown. And this seems to be a particularly popular pursuit among historical novelists these days. Why do you think it is in this post-truth era that readers are so fascinated about those parts of history that we never learned about in school?
Well, that's the point. They didn't learn about them in school because they took history and they had this boring class that all they had to learn were all these facts and people and dates and crap. I mean, that even bores me. I mean, and I like history. That bores me to tears. So I get it. You got to find the cool stuff, the very interesting stuff, the stuff that kind of grabs you and you go like, is that real? Yeah, it actually is real. It actually did happen. And here's why it's relevant, and here's why it makes sense, and here's where it fits in, and here's all there. That's what people like. People like a story. And if you tell history to people in a story, they'll listen to you, and they'll be fascinated by it. My wife hated history. She couldn't stand it. She thought it was the most boring thing on earth. But she likes stories. Yeah. She likes stories, and she enjoys stories, and she enjoys reading my book because there's a story there, and she's learning something when she doesn't even realize she's learning it. And that's what we try to do with these novels. There's only a few of us writing in this genre. There's not as many as we need. We probably need some more in the genre, but it's a tight little field of people that are doing it, particularly those who do it year in and year out. There's only a handful of us that do it year in and year out. Dan is our king. He's the king of the genre, but he only does it every few years. Where there's the rest of us do it, you know, once a year. So it's hard to do it year in and year out, but luckily I'm okay for the next 2-3 years.
Okay. How do you think reading about the past helps us understand the present better?
Well, because they repeat themselves over and over again. And they really do repeat themselves over and over again. And if you're cognizant of something that had happened before, you kind of go like, well, wait, we've already been there. We've already done this. We've already been down this road. So you have to be cognizant of the past because we're human beings and we tend to repeat. We're like television shows. We have about 22 first run episodes and the rest of them get repeated over and over and over and over again. And you got to be cognizant of those repeats.
Tell us a little bit about an organization called History Matters and your involvement with that.
Elizabeth and I created that about, now it's been about 14 years ago. And we go around and help communities raise money for historic preservation. We do that through dinners, galas, luncheons, where they sell tickets, and we're part of the show of that. We also do it through a writer's workshop where we teach the craft of writing. We've taught about 3,000 students. You buy your way into the workshop with a contribution, and all of that money goes to the project. We've raised almost $3 million for about 90-something projects around the country. We've been shut down in 2021, 22. We're gearing up now to get back at it in 23.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Fantastic. And you were also a founding member of the International Thriller Writers. You know, I've been involved with a literary nonprofit here in Winston-Salem that has done such a great job of creating community out of something that is necessarily a solitary experience, whether that's reading or writing. I mean, those are things that we tend to do by ourselves. Tell us a little bit about International Thrillers and about the importance of building community for writers.
ITW is like the guild for thriller writers around the world. There's about 6,000 members. When I was co-president, we had about 200 members. So it's grown a lot in those years. It is a community. It does bring them all together. It connects them together. They have Thriller Fest every year, which is the gathering of thriller writers in New York City. It happens in May of every year. And it's like summer camp for thriller writers and thriller enthusiasts, even though now it takes place right before the summer. It used to be in July, but now it's in late May, early June. So it's a great place to go to co-mingle and coexist with other thriller writers. A lot goes on during that time. So it's an organization that the genre desperately needed, and it's been around now for about 17 years.
That's fantastic, fantastic. And you said you've got the next 2 or 3 years planned out. Can you give us any hints about what Cotton Malone might be up to in the future?
Sure. Yeah, we have some interesting things coming over the next 3 years, actually. I'm going to have 2 books a year for the next 3 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I have a new book, you know, coming out now. The Last Kingdom is coming out, which is Cotton Malone's adventure. June 27th, Luke Daniels is getting his own book. And Luke is the younger character that appears in the Cotton books. And he's getting 3 novels, that first of which will come this year. It's called The Ninth Man, and it deals with the Kennedy assassination and something from that that I think will shock readers, that will go like, whoa, I had no idea. I can't write 2 books a year by myself, unfortunately. So the great thriller writer Grant Blackwood is helping me with the Luke Daniels books. And so Grant and I put that first book together. Next spring will be the next Cotton Malone book. It's called The Atlas Maneuver. It's a really cool book that deals with Bitcoin. Mm. That'll be out. That's a subject that fascinates me. And something from history that I think will surprise people as well. And then Luke will come next June. And then the following year will be the next Cotton Malone book, which I'm writing right now, and another Luke Daniels book. So for the next 3 years, there'll be 2 Steve Berry books a year, which is pretty cool.
That sounds like you'd be busy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. You should be able to answer each of them in just a few words. But hopefully they'll give our listeners some insight into writing and into you. So if you're ready, we will begin.
All right, let's try it.
What word do you love to work into your writing?
What word do I like to edit into in writing? I don't know if I have a word. I do. I tell you this, I do every book have a word I overuse. Mm-hmm. And I have to get it out. And it changes with every book. So I would probably say I don't have a word that I work into every book, but there is one that I need to work out of every book.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes. But now,
what word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
It's a 4-letter word. It's one that should never appear anywhere in a novel in any place. And it's the word well, W-E-L-L. Okay. You know, people go, well, I don't know what I'm going to do. Well, I'm going to go here. Well, it drives me crazy, the overuse of well.
Yeah. Where's your favorite place to write?
At my desk. I wrote every word I've ever written at this desk. I bought it at Sam's in the 1980s, and I practiced law at this desk, and I still have it to this day.
Yeah. Where could you never write?
On the road. I'm not good writing on the road at all. That's just not something I can do very well.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
There's quite a few. Like commas are my biggest one. I only use a comma where the I needs a break. I do not use it where the rule of grammar says. So if you don't need to break with your I keep right on going.
What was the first book you remember reading?
Oh, that was easy. Hardy Boys. Hardy Boys. Absolutely. I loved them.
What are you reading now?
A lot of research for the 2025 novel. I can't tell you what that is because I don't want to give away what it'd be. Somebody might grab it and go with it. But I'm reading a lot of stuff on that subject right now.
Yeah. What book would you like to have written?
Oh, wow. I would love to have written one of Michener's novels. Wow. I loved Michener. He was the greatest writer. He was just fantastic. I wish I could stop what I'm doing and actually write a Michener-like novel. I would love to do that.
Well, that sort of leads us to the next question, which is, what sort of book would you like to write but probably never will?
Pure historical fiction or sci-fi.
Oh, okay.
I actually wrote 10,000 words of a sci-fi novel, which I'd love to finish one day.
And finally, what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
That my books allowed them to forget their troubles in the world for a little while and just have a good time. To me, that's the best compliment a writer can get. Mm-hmm.
This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and my guest today has been Steve Barry, whose novel, The Last Kingdom, will soon be available wherever books are sold. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Inside the Writer's Studio is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a community gathering place and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks and all its programs, visit www.bookmarksnc.org. Inside the Writer's Studio is proud to be affiliated with Libro FM. Unlike other audiobook platforms, Libro FM supports your local independent bookstore. Whether you buy a single book or, like me, a monthly subscription, you can link your account to your local store or to Bookmarks to support literary community. For a special 2-for-1 offer, go to Libro.fm and use the discount code WRITERS. If you've enjoyed Inside the Writer's Studio, please consider leaving a rating or review online at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Inside the Writer's Studio posts new episodes on the 1st and 15th of every month. On the 1st of this month, I had my first grandchild, so I'm a bit distracted these days, but I hope to be bringing you some new episodes soon. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.